Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an asset management firm providing comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for long-term growth and capital preservation. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com. Support for WPR comes from Stoughton Health, an independent community healthcare organization, treating acute mental health disorders in adults age 55 and over, accepting many insurance plans. StoughtonHealth.com.
Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Classic rock. It might conjure up memories of bell-bottom jeans, wide-collared shirts, or even Richard Nixon, but there's so much more to it than that. Why? Because classic rock's audience continues to evolve, and classic rock has become one of the most successful formats introduced in the past 25 years. It might surprise you to learn that the format continues to grow. There was an 8% increase in listener share for classic rock in 2017, that according to Nielsen. Over the last few years, there's been a surge in young listeners attracted to the genre more than ever before. You might think that millennials are all about Beyoncé and Bieber, but studies show they're also open to other types of music, and one they love is classic rock. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seward from Wausau Pilot and Review, guest hosting this week for Glenn Moberg. Today we'll explore the multi-generational appeal of classic rock and its continuing influence on our culture today. So how does classic rock resonate with you? What song immediately comes to mind when you hear the words classic rock, and why? Join the conversation at 800-780-9742. That's 800-780-9742. Let's quickly introduce our guest. Duff Damos is the operations manager of NRG Media Northwoods. He is a familiar voice in central and northern Wisconsin after spending 40 years in radio broadcasting in many different formats, from hit music to country and then to classic rock. He began his career in Minocqua, then spent 18 years at WIFC in Wausau before moving back to the Northwoods to head up six NRG Media stations. Mitch Vigut is a songwriter, studio engineer, and longtime musician. An Athens native now living in Wausau, Mitch has produced more than 200 records for a range of artists. He wrote and performed songs as a guitarist with Aircraft, a band that released six singles over four albums in the 80s and 90s and achieved an international cult following. Today, he performs with John Altenberg as part of the blues group Johnny and the Motones. Welcome, both of you, and thanks for being with us today on Route 51. Duff, let's start by defining exactly what classic rock is. How is it different from oldies?
Well, good morning, first of all. Thanks for having me on. No pun intended, Shereen, but oldies is kind of a thing of the past as a format now. Obviously, the music is great, but it kind of sounds dated. Oldies music of the 60s and 70s, we remember, was basically the top 40 of that era. Sure. We remember the big stations back then. Oldies is pop music, everything from early rock, you know, Elvis to the Beatles to Motown. There were crossovers from oldies and classic rock, meaning you remember Cream, the Beatles, Rolling Stones. They were successful in both genres. Now, classic rock focuses more on heavier rock music like AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Hendrix, Grand Funk Railroad. The list goes on. You wouldn't hear 1910 Fruit Gum Company on a classic rock station, nor would you hear Black Sabbath on an oldies station. It just doesn't mesh. Back in those times, rock stations were known as album-oriented rock stations.
Right.
They played current music, heavier artists, and the album cuts you wouldn't hear anywhere else. Just so happened that those cuts became huge classics.
Yeah.
Remember Led Zeppelin's Kashmir, Jimi Hendrix, so many others. Oldies stations now are shifting. They're moving away from that era, and they're focusing more on the 70s and 80s.
Okay.
Many folks seem it's something new. When you really think about it, we're coming up on 30 years for the late 70s and 80s. Hard to believe.
Yeah. Yes, it's hard to believe. Yeah. We're getting old, my friend.
Oh, my gosh. The oldies format, they've evolved into what they now label as classic hits now. That's shifted over to that. So
sure.
Oldies kind of is, but classic rock lives on.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, Mitch, you know, I saw your performance in Denver in December, actually, with the annual Altenburg Christmas show. You know, I always MC that. It's always a great deal of fun. And I know from listening to it over the years that you always are featured in the songs that have more of a rock, a classic rock flavor. I can't tell you how many times I've heard you do Run, Rudolph, Run. Always fantastic. So what defines that classic rock sound for you?
First of all, how about it's a privilege to be on the radio with Duff Damos.
No kidding.
Duff, remember you played our first record in 1982, Alien Probe?
Are you kidding? I remember all of them.
What a great, and the voice of the voices. Shereen, we were just talking about that. But I don't know, it's, to me, classic rock goes back to the early 70s, late 60s when we had... Duff, you remember Inagata Da Vida? It went on for, what, 20 minutes? Did you ever play that on the radio?
Oh, yeah. We used to call that the bathroom
break song. Bathroom
break
song, yes. That's what you played when you had to take a break.
Right. But, you know, the classic rock seemed like when I started my guitar playing in 1969, got a Fender Strat from old Jerry's Music, and the first thing everybody got back then was a fuzz tone. And that was the thing that created hard rock, I think, with a little different edge. The older songs like the Beach Boys, the Four Tops, you know, stuff like that did not have an edge. And all of a sudden we came out with Inagata Da Vida and Spirit in the Sky, mm-hmm. Norman Greenbaum.
Mm-hmm. The Rolling Stones, I can't get no satisfaction.
Yeah, the sound had a different sound, and it was like, that's kind of what propelled me into playing guitar. I loved that sound.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden that came in on the radio, and I think that kind of started the date of classic rock with that.
Sure.
Finally the guitar became distorted. We had Zeppelin and Sabbath and Grand Funk and
Yeah. Well, Duff, I was just looking at the Statistica records, and classic rock is voted the favorite genre among groups spanning 35 to 65 plus. Almost half of listeners, even ages 25 to 34, consider it their favorite. I mean, even these young people are really getting into it. You spent so many years in the radio business, and you worked in so many different formats, but the music of the 70s is still such a cornerstone for many radio groups, including your own. So what do you think it is about classic rock that appeals to so many age groups? Why are the young people getting into it? What are some of the enduring qualities of classic rock?
Well, a lot of it is the younger people, there's many songs that they've never heard before. So this is fresh and new to them. I think a lot of it has to do with that era, though. There were a lot of historic things that happened in those days. Politics, war, corruption, it was everywhere in the 60s and 70s. We all remember that.
Sure.
So many of the things were focused on the music back then, too. Classic rock was the format that played heavy on that.
Mm-hmm.
Protest songs, Crosby, Stills, and Nash did so well. The lyrics were so strong back then. The music was simple, like I think Mitch would agree with that, but so many people remember the lyrics because the lyrics, for the most part, had a definite meaning, and they told a story. I mean, you can hear people singing all these classic rock songs. So many people can still relate to those lyrics, too. That's those times, many memories they bring back. High school proms, you remember, they were theme-based on songs. Graduations were theme-based.
Sure.
It all had meaning that affected people's lives, and the music was raw and real. And, yes, they actually produced songs with technology back then. They called it stereo.
Yes, yes.
I remember I had a KP500 Yamaha. Uh-huh. You remember that? In your car? It was like, yeah,
now everything
it sounded
is,
great.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound like an old guy, but, well, I am. But everything is so compressed, and people are used to the Bluetooth speakers where there's no separation. The production in the studio, which Mitch will agree, was raw. But for the most part, it was so well thought out. Also, back then we had albums. A lot of thought was put into the packaging, liner notes, lyrics, pictures. It was an experience when you went out and bought an album. You got it home, you put it on the turntable, and then you started going through the album cover, the artwork, and everything else. It was just so cool back then, and it was an experience to buy an album and go through it, and you remember those things.
The process of making an album back in the day, so you took your tape, and then you had to take it to a mastering engineer who actually made templates of that record. you know, today that technology is gone because it's all digital to digital to digital. So I think that kind of enhanced the sound a little bit back in the
Well, I have to tell you, I still love the experience of buying records. We have a huge vinyl collection. We have a fantastic turntable that we love that experience that you were talking about going to Innersleeve in downtown Wausau and you know, thumbing through the album collection. He's got a great vinyl collection, and picking up that album and looking at the liner notes and looking at the artwork. It's a totally different experience than just clicking download and grabbing it off of iTunes or Spotify. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just a different experience. I do want
How cool was that when you went and got that album? Not only the experience of the album, but Mike would give you an inner sleeve.
Yes, he still does. He still does. Yeah.
And that's so cool. Another thing, too, it's very rare to find a formula in classic rock, meaning not too often did two songs that sound the same. I mean, everything was so different back then. I'm not cutting down today's music or country, but I think many people would agree those formats now are based on formula.
Yes.
Right. And it progressed into progressive rock. You had the Yeses and the Emerson, Lake and Palmers and those groups. You don't hear that today anymore because it was so progressive.
That was written music. I mean, that, it was incredible what these guys had come up with. Now, talk about bathroom break songs. There's some bathroom break
songs. Oh, no kidding. No kidding. Yeah, absolutely. Some long stuff. I do want to invite callers to join the conversation. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Again, 800-780-9742. You know, classic rock ranked number one in total album sales in 2017. Number two was R&B and hip-hop, but I've got to tell you, I still think R&B has those solid roots in the 70s music area. There is an undeniable connection to the disco movement, and I know when people hear disco, they roll their eyes, but I just think disco of the early 70s is one of those things that was cool before it was cool. That fusion, that the harmonies, disco began in the nightclubs, but then it moved into the mainstream. I mean, think about Saturday Night Fever. Listen to this. You know, this is such a classic. Duff, I know you like this stuff.
Oh my God.
I never looked good in Angel's Flight pants, though.
All right, Mitch, I know you're more of a rock and roll guy than
you've ever been
a disco
guy.
What?
Stop.
I know he's dancing.
Yeah, he was. He was moving in his chair.
All rockers from the 70s hated disco.
All of them?
Everyone. I never knew one that didn't.
Oh, you should have seen our phones light up constantly in that era.
Oh, yeah. And even from artists like ELO and Queen and Kiss, I mean, they even made some disco-y songs.
Think about it, though. When I was 1973 to 1977, I was in my teens. We played every weekend. Clubs had 500 to 700 people in them. We'd play the Airway in Marshfield or Rhinelander. They were packed. Mm-hmm. People came back from Vietnam, and they all went out and did this live thing. And when disco came, all of a sudden, our gigs dried up. So, rock bands hated disco. I mean, it was like everywhere you looked. And then, one of my best days of my life was when they had the disco burning party at Kaminsky Park.
Oh!
Duff, you remember that one?
Oh yeah, Steve Dahl.
Oh, burned it all, you know, kill it all. It killed the classic rock song. That's the way we thought of it in 1977.
Sure.
But a lot of people, you know, enjoyed it. And now looking back, you really do appreciate what the era spoke for itself. But at the time, it was like, it was brutal for people that like classic rock
and
all this stuff from the time. And being a musician, like I said, it just wiped out the clubs.
Yeah.
What about a formula?
Right. Yeah. And then you did see some of those traditional rock bands, like even the Rolling Stones, had some songs that had a little bit of a disco flair, like they were trying to pick that up. Kiss's I Was Made for Loving You. Tell me that's not a disco song.
They had to
do that to survive back then, basically.
The record companies said, hey, come on, we got to follow the times here. Let's go in and produce some stuff, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose. Well, I don't know. Is there any disco you like, Mitch?
Oh, I like it now.
You like
it
now?
Yeah, you have to appreciate it now. But
sure.
At the time, it was like, oh, my God, this music is horrible. What happened to where's my Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple albums? What's going on here?
I loved a lot of the disco because of the production value. I mean, they put some heavy production into a lot of these things, and it was like, wow, does that sound cool?
Mm-hmm. Shireen liked it because she was at the King's Night having all the guys looking at her while she was shaking it on lighted dance floor.
The Utopia Lounge. Yeah, there were all those dance clubs back then.
Lighted dance floor.
Yeah. I love it. Well, I've got to tell people that they can join the conversation. If you have an opinion, you want to ask a question, give us a call. 800-780-9742 is the number to call. We are talking with Duff Damos and Mitch Vigut on Route 51. I think it's about time to take a break. And we've got, about a minute left before we take a break? All right, we'll take a break. When we return, we're going to discuss the dominance of FM radio and the tech advances of the 70s. I know we touched on this a little bit in this segment, but we'll talk a little bit about that some more. You know, that really changed the future of music forever. There is room for comments and questions. You can join us by calling 800-780-9742. Again, 800-780-9742. We would love to hear from you. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back. We're talking with Duff Damos and Mitch Vigut on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. We want to hear from you, too. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. That's 800-780-9742. I got a couple of texts over the last couple of minutes. I know they're listening to us over at the Domtar Control Room, so thanks for tuning in. We love that. FM radio broadcasts go back to the 1930s, but by the end of the 60s, radio really became known for that freeform and progressive sound, and that led into album-oriented rock, that format, the AOR format we talked about a little bit earlier. And I would say that it's difficult to pinpoint exactly when FM overtook AM in North America, but maybe one turning point might be 1978 when FM stations first accounted for a majority of the top 10 stations in the top 50 market. Now, Duff, over the years, you and I have had a lot of conversations about this, the way that radio stations sound and how that matters from a technical standpoint. FM, higher fidelity, less static. What did the evolution of FM mean to radio broadcasting?
Well, AM radio uses ground waves, sky waves. I don't want to get too technical. Back in the old days, like you mentioned, a big plus because you could listen to the big AM stations like WLS, you know, and all those biggies real clear at night. The signal would travel great distances in your car on your little portable, and you always had a clock radio next to your bed. Now, FM needs height. It's a line of sight, so it's not a distance signal. So far exceeds on the band spectrum now, they call it. The FM radio actually started in a completely other band spectrum back in the 30s, like you said. It went away for a while, came back in the 88 to 108 on the dial. It introduced a better sound, quieter signal with no static. It was in stereo. Remember that word, stereo?
Yes. Yes.
In the beginning, FM was not all, it wasn't profitable like AM radio was. Part of that was not a lot of people had FM radios. Most cars didn't have them. A lot of folks may remember back in the old days, Mitch, you remember these? You could purchase this little device you'd put in your car and it would convert the AM radio to an FM signal.
Yeah, my favorite thing is we used to go out on Saturday nights and listen to, I think it was Beaker Theater on WKY Little Rock.
Yep.
And it's like that's where you got all your influences in music. Because
it was real freaky. You know, it was kind of like FM on AM.
Yeah, and you could get you know, they were playing Rush and all this mm-hmm. crazy album cuts that you'd never hear, right? There was no internet or anything. You only had...
Right. Now, on FM back in the day, believe it or not, we talked about disco. Disco got its start on FM radio because it was a genre that they didn't play on AM yet, mm-hmm. and it was produced like it was. So disco started and kind of kicked off FM, and then FM decided, well, AM is the top 40, and we're going to go different. We're going on FM. We're going to start doing underground and the rock music and things like that. AM was extremely profitable where FM was, and eventually FM did take over with the sound quality and technology. Today we've got processing and everything else that makes it sound just crystal clear and clean. AM had to scurry a little bit. You remember the days of AM stereo?
No.
Yeah, AM stereo really didn't take off, and they say the rest is history. As everybody knows today, AM radio is more for talk, and FM still mostly music intensive.
It kind of came in, Duff, am I right with this? The 8-track went out, and the cassette tape came in, and you had Radio Shack coming to town. You could put 8x10 speakers in your car in 1977, and then you got certain FM radios that sounded great.
Yeah. Hey, Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to stomp on you.
He had talked about 8-tracks, and it was like,
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh, I hate when it did. And it'd get to the end of track one, but it'd be in the middle of a song.
Yeah.
Then it'd go to track two and then fade that song. Oh, it's terrible technology.
It was terrible technology. That's why it doesn't exist anymore. Hey, we have a caller, Joe from Stevens Point. I think we have Joe on the phone. Hello, Joe.
Hey, no, you go ahead. my question, it sort of fades into it a little bit. All these great bands from the 60s, 70s, and 80s even had so many songs. Why do I only hear four from each one? I mean, who has done a lot more than Won't Get Fooled Again?
Sure. That's a good point. Maybe you can answer that, Duff. I mean, how come radio programmers seem to pick those same few songs from each band that that they play instead of going a little bit further?
Well, like everything else, radio is a business, and things are focus grouped, and things are tested, and you try to go by what the most popular songs are. There aren't a lot of underground stations that play. We'd have to have a library that you wouldn't believe if we played everything that everybody calls in and wants to hear.
Sure.
You have to draw the line somewhere, and you have to do by what the mass appeal wants to hear. Otherwise, as a business, you're not going to have people listening. I would love to play Low Spark, A High-Heeled Boy every day and things like that. But the mass appeal just doesn't understand a lot of that music and the album cuts. And like I used to say years ago, that's why they make albums. You can enjoy that at home. You may not hear it all the time on the radio. You may not hear it at all on the radio. But that was part of the fascination of albums, too. Hey, you hear this song on side two? I never hear it on the radio, but it's a great song. Check it out. So being a business, you have to, just like any other business, you have to do what your customers want, the mass audience.
Sure. That makes sense. And thanks, Joe. I appreciate the call. Anyone else who has a question can certainly call 800-780-9742. Now, the technological advances in the 70s, you know, we talked a little bit about this from a production standpoint. More tracks were available in the studio. Recording engineers found new ways to use them. They kind of went to this technique of putting microphones close to the instruments instead of capturing the full room sound and sequestered musicians in separate rooms, and every track was like a separate piece of the puzzle that producers could swap in and out. They called it a dry as a bone sound, and we got a lot with West Coast groups like the Eagles and Steely Dan, and even the straightforward rock like AC/DC and ZZ Top. Let's take a little listen here.
Uh,
Oh, I love that song. So, you know, Mitch, you've been recording in engineering studio recordings for so long. So, for you, how did the technology change over the years?
Well, let's go back to the start. You know, you used to have a 2-inch 24-track tape that every record pretty much was made on, and then in the late 70s, they sunk two machines up. So when you got to 24 tracks versus the 4 or 8 tracks that you had in the 60s with the Beatles and early Aerosmith, you could, if you listen to this song, you'll hear a guitar in the right ear, another guitar in the left ear. So every time they were re-recording, they'd redo the guitar parts multiple times, get that wall of sound, mm-hmm. and just a better stereo production. That was kind of how technology took care of everything back in the day.
Sure. Things really changed.
Today, you know, you have a computer that can edit anything with a click of a mouse.
Right.
You know, back in the old days, I don't know, Duff, you remember, I don't know if you guys had to cut tape and radio, but you would record 24 tracks of vocals, and then you'd record them to a 2-track, and then you'd like hold your finger on the 2-track and try to slide them into the song to get the vocals and stuff like that onto your tape. But the tape also gave a real compressed sound that I don't think you get with the digital recording nowadays.
Sure.
Okay. Pretty amazing. I know in Nashville now they have like 1979 is a real popular studio, and it's got all the old tape, all the old technologies, and that was the stuff we were always yelling and getting mad about.
Because, sure.
Yeah, the splice the tape and the whole song goes to heck or whatever, and you know.
Yeah, well, Duff, you and I weren't, you know, making music, but you know, we had to do a lot of different things when we were creating ads and you know, creating the spots for advertisers back in the day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we'd do 60-second promos for album weekend giveaways, and it would take an hour to do that 60-second promo because you would want to put effects in it. You would have to splice it here to get a real good edit. And, yeah, it took a while, but it was fun.
It's amazing nowadays. I don't know how the new engineers do it because technology, there's like 5,000 compressors and 5,000 reverbs and back in the old days, we actually had a knob you would turn to get more ratio of compression. You could hear it. Nowadays, with your computer, there's so many options. It's like it's endless to know what the effect is. Mm-hmm. I just had a funny story back when Glenn Klotkin was here and worked on one of our albums. And he told me the story when they were working with Jimi Hendrix at Electric Ladyland that they were leaning on the 2-track as it was going with the 24-track, and that created the phasing, you know, that you hear in Hendrix's original stuff.
Okay.
He was one of the guys that was holding the 2-track down.
Oh, wow,
so that
okay.
The phase of the tapes would make, you know, nowadays you could click a button and get that effect forever,
sure.
But that was like, wow.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
We used to run 2 tape machines, and we'd count down from 10 and then do the little sentence you wanted to do. And then you'd go back and you'd hold the tape. So, you'd get that phasing effect.
Yeah.
But it took forever.
Yes.
I mean, I'd like a lot of the new technology because it doesn't take forever.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
That was a lot of pain in the butt back in the day.
Yeah. We're going to go to the phone. We have a caller named Dennis. Dennis is from Ripon. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Someone had mentioned WLS, and I remember listening to that station at night on my little transistor radio, and, you know, to a 15-year-old boy in central Wisconsin, Chicago was a world away, and Yvonne Daniels on at night had the sexiest voice I ever heard.
Next to Shireen. No.
Yeah. Oh, those are great memories, yes. I mean, I think that that's part of the lure of classic rock today, and you know, when we listen to these old songs, because we remember that those experiences listening when we were kids. I remember sitting at the pool, Memorial Pool, and Duff, you were on the air then, and every 30 minutes you'd tell us it was time to flip over, and if we were laying out in the sun,
that's a public service.
Yes, time to flip over. Just, you know, all those memories really, really come back to you when you hear these songs, and it takes you back to a different time. Duff, you know, you've been a program director for a long time. You were a program director at a hit music station. And, you know, back then in the 70s, 80s, 90s, the program directors really played a huge role deciding which records would make it, which records would be played. And you had to have an ear for what listeners would want to hear. Can you think of a record that the minute you put the needle on the record and you heard it for the first time, you thought, yep, that's going to be a hit?
Oh, wow. There were so many, actually. If I remember correctly, you even were in on some of those music meetings.
Yes.
Now, back in the top 40 days, Take On Me, I guess. Uh-huh. That brings them. Donny Iris. Remember Donny Iris, Mitch?
Yeah, Donny Iris.
Eurythmics, Sweet Dreams. I went, what is it? Joan Jett, I Love Rock and Roll. The Bangles, Walk Like an Egyptian. That's another one. I was like, this is never going to be a hit.
But
look at it.
But, yeah.
We could do this all morning. We could do a whole other show on...
Well, then you had Jeff McCluskey, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Promoting the crap out of the stuff for the area, which were the record promoters, which is a whole other...
That's a whole other show in
show
itself.
Show in itself.
But,
Oh, yeah.
But, so, Duff, what songs or bands are the most popular or most requested in our listening area? I mean, what do you get the most requests for?
Classic rock is not just in a listening area. That's what we're talking about. Classic rock is so broad, and it's like that older. There are, other than some Midwest regional standards, you remember Head East?
Oh, yeah.
That was more of a Midwestern band. Mm-hmm. It was huge in the Midwest. They played it out in the West and in the East, but it was they had those bands like that.
I played with Head East probably 20 times.
Yeah,
we toured with them
out there. They're still doing it,
and
pretty much standard all over with a lot of Southern rock. I love Southern rock too. The Allman Brothers Band, Lynyrd Skynyrd, huge on album radio back then, and huge today in classic rock. Very popular in the Midwest too over the years.
Sure, and Head East was touring with Styx a couple of years ago. I mean, they're still making music, and I got to introduce the band when they were playing, and I still remember they drove up in their Suburban, you know, they just had like a bucket of beer that they were drinking back there. They weren't this big
standard
tour band or anything, you know. They just packed their backpacks and their music into this beat up Suburban, and it was great.
We had the. We played with Cheap Trick at the Airway in Marshfield back in 1974
mm-hmm.
on a night like tonight, 20 below zero, and our bus started on fire because we were trying to start it with starting fluid, and we were parked right next to their bus. So we had to have six guys push our bus away because we thought we were going to burn Cheap Trick's bus down.
Oh, no.
Man.
You know. Well, changing technology. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, there were some real changes made in the 70s. Let's talk a little bit about some of that. The Polymoog, it's a weird name for a portable polyphonic synth, 71 keys. You might remember the video from Gary Numan's hit The Cars from 1979. It was prominent in that, and then it also appeared a year earlier in Blondie's Heart of Glass. And who can forget the way that sounded? You know, it was a really distinctive sound. It started in the 70s, but it really dominated the 80s music scene. And I know, Mitch, Duff, you were talking about Eurythmics' Sweet Dreams. It's that same kind of sound, that same kind of synth that really took that over. Mitch, when I listened to the music of Aircraft, your band, you know, had a couple of huge hits in the 80s, but I hear influences from both decades. I can hear some 70s in there. I can hear some 80s in there. Did any artists now consider classic rock have a solid influence on your sound?
I think when we first started, we just loved Grand Funk Railroad, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple. It was, you know, Jimmy mm-hmm. Page over and over. And what, our first album came out in 1982. Alien Probe was the first single that Duffer played all the time. Thank you, Duff.
You're welcome.
Well, there it is.
Yeah, here it is. Let's listen. Woo! I love that. I think it's just so well produced too. But the 80s, it also brought out a number of bands and solo artists that had more of that blue collar sound. We're talking about Van Halen, John Mellencamp, Bon Jovi, Springsteen, and the list goes on and on. And there were bands that crossed over between pop and rock, like Journey and Styx. Those bands also dominated the charts. Duff, how did bands like that, like those, turn classic rock into kind of everyone's genre?
Well, these bands brought mainstream to rock. Huge top 40 hits, obviously. They also had huge album hits at the time. They had it made. They had both formats going. They played on rock radio. Incredibly smart on their part, too. They not only sold albums to the top 40 teens, but serious rock lovers loved the album cuts. Sold a lot of albums, made their base more broad, and also did the same at the live performances, like their concerts. Years ago, a lot of those bands toured to sell albums. That's mm-hmm. what they toured for. They didn't make a lot of money on tour. Mitch, you remember that.
Yeah, everybody, you could actually make money on a record, you know.
But it was necessary. They had to do it to push the sales of the album. Completely different today, though. Totally opposite, I think. Bands are making their money on live performances, not album sales.
100%,
Don't they call it downloads now?
Yeah, now you're getting one-tenth of a penny for a download,
right.
You know.
That's the reason insane. Concerts are so expensive, too. They have to do it. Concerts are way more of an event now. The production, the lighting, lasers, fire, video screens. It's incredible to go to a show if you can afford it nowadays. All the 80s rock music is relevant today simply, I think, because it was the soundtrack of most people's lives then and remains that even today, I think.
Absolutely. For me personally, I gravitate toward the music of the 70s and 80s because I feel like it's more multi-layered, it's more complex, and I don't want to diss today's music, but I just feel like that music was so technologically perfect. You didn't have auto-tune. This was just, really talented musicians who were incredibly intelligent, who delivered the goods. Tom Petty, such a perfectionist. Tom Scholz from Boston, he was an MIT graduate. Brian May from Queen as a PhD in astrophysics. These were smart guys putting out smart music, smart records. I mean, Duff, what are some of the most technologically perfect songs that you can think of from that era?
Oh, boy, like Mitch. I mean, Mitch was a geek in the studio. Tom Scholz, look at him. You said he went to MIT.
Yes.
He was a technical producer, too. In fact, Boston's debut album, done in Tom's basement. He had a little studio down there, and he did everything. Tom was also, he invented, I don't know if you remember the Rockman.
No.
You remember the Walkman FM radios and the Discman?
You did not. You could play guitar, but you did not have to have an amp. It was just a little tiny box,
really,
like four times the size of a cell phone.
Yep.
And he played and recorded through that.
Yeah, it looked just like a Walkman, but you could plug your guitar into it, and he made a lot of money off that device. You could play to your heart's content, and not bother anybody in the house. Which Queen. There's a band that the multi-layering and the vocals that they'd come up with. Freddie Mercury would. No other band sounded like Boston. No other band sounded like Queen. They can say the same, which it's given them the staying power, I think. Bands like that you hear, even if it isn't a song that you may know, you'll know that it's Boston or Queen just from the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Tom Petty.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of progressive rock bands like Genesis were the same, too. That, to me, is staying power that you just don't see anymore.
Absolutely. Well, it's time to take a break. You're listening to Duff Damos and Mitch Vigood on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. When we return, we're going to hop across the pond. We're talking about the staying power of some British musical acts, and we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary of one of the most influential albums in music history. There's room for questions and comments for listeners. We encourage you to call in 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742.
Down.
Welcome back. We're talking to Duff Damos and Mitch Vigut on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward in for Glenn Moberg. We want to hear from you, too. Join us by calling 800-780-9742 with your comments and your memories. That's 1-800-780-9742. In addition to the Great American Band, some of the most enduring music of the classic rock era came from some British artists, too. Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie about Freddie Mercury and Queen, just won a Golden Globe for Best Picture. I don't know if you guys saw it. Fantastic movie. There's also a new movie about Elton John coming out this spring. And Beatlemania continues 50 years after the White Album was released. Now, there is no question that the music of the Beatles continues to resonate with people. SiriusXM has a designated Beatles channel. And, of course, Paul McCartney's current live tour continues to sell out. He's playing at Lambeau Field in June. Can't wait to see him in concert. So, you know, there's just something about it. Compared with Paul's songs, though, you know, I have to say, Paul's songs all seem to keep in some sort of touch with reality, right? But John's were a little bit different. They had that psychedelic, mystical quality, the imagery, one of the best things about his work, the tangerine trees, the marmalade skies, the cellophane flowers. You know, he was kind of this oral Salvador Dali. Mitch, you and I were just talking about McCartney a couple weeks ago. You were sitting in my office and we were talking about him coming to Lambeau Field. And what do you think it is about Paul McCartney that keeps those crowds coming back?
Well, I think from a classic rock perspective, every guitar player that wrote a classic rock song from the 70s and 80s learned Blackbird on guitar.
Okay.
Right? Blackbirds, okay. You know. And the Beatles had such an influence on basically every musician from that era that, you know, things like to progress along really good that way.
Yeah, absolutely. We have Jim from Arborvita on the phone. Welcome, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to say it was like going down memory lane. I kind of cut into the middle of your broadcast, but everything you were talking about just rings true with me from the point that someone started talking about the Innersleeve record.
Oh, yeah.
Shop down in Wausau. I still have my records from Innersleeve with the Innersleeve, and for some odd reason, I kept most of the receipts with those. So I actually still have his written out receipts going back to 1976. So
wow.
And of course, that's where I bought my first Boston album, was their inaugural album, and I bought that from the Innersleeve, and that was the place to go for, especially a couple of us from the dorm down in Wausau, because I moved up from North Carolina to Wausau and started school at the UW down there. And like I said, at the dorm, you usually heard IFC on the and Duff Damus on the on as you pass every dorm room. So
yeah,
I just want to mention too, guys. It's funny when you mentioned Angel Flight Pants. I said, yes, I had a pair of those. And yes, I went to Utopia, but I first started dancing at Sneaky Pete's before it became the mining company.
Oh, yes, Sneaky Pete's. So, yes, that's right.
Yeah. So I just wanted to mention that. I wanted to thank you for all that music, and especially that FM sound, because when I moved up from North Carolina, the rural town I was living in, North Carolina, we did not have an FM station at that time. It was all AM in 76. So you had to go to the big cities for the FM stations. So,
well, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it, Jim. Thanks.
Yes. Have a good day. Thank you.
You too. Thanks. Well, certainly we have so many memories tied into these songs. The Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, also among the most popular bands of the era, the most influential. And those songs continue to see significant airplay today. Rolling Stones made the most money per show performed in 2016. They made $91 million from just 14 concerts. I mean, these guys are average age 73. I don't even know. Mitch, you know, what is it about the Stones on stage that keeps satisfying audiences so much? I mean, people are willing to pay hundreds of dollars, sometimes thousands, for the chance to see them live.
I think as we get closer to the retirement age of us baby boomers right now, that the experiences we had as kids, we'll pay whatever to go relive that again. And look at the Rolling Stones at this age. They're still there. playing and doing it, and we have the opportunity, you know, to see a Paul McCartney, Rolling Stones, Billy Joel. It's just amazing. I mean, it's well worth the money, and I think people aren't afraid to dish out whatever it takes to relive those experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about Freddie Mercury and Queen. A lot of renewed interest in Queen with the movie Bohemian Rhapsody. I don't know if either one of you had a chance to see that film, but I highly recommend it. It's great stuff. One of the things that that really came out in the film was that Freddie didn't care what the critics thought. He didn't care what the record executives thought. I mean, he was willing to walk out of the record exec's office because he didn't like Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, they were revolutionary because they did their own thing. Duff, can you talk a little bit about that? Those artists who didn't fit the mold, like Queen, that had to scare you a little bit, right?
Well, yeah, but kudos to them. They sure were successful. They did their own thing. They stuck to their guns. And, boy, look at it, the music that they made. It's just and lives on. How many times has Bohemian Rhapsody been a hit when you think about it?
Hasn't it been released, what, three times at least?
I think, yeah, three times it's been a hit. Now, there's no other band, there's no other artist in history that's ever done anything like that. So it's amazing when you think about it. And again, not to cut down or anything today's music or anything, but what artists can you think of that are current that we're going to probably say, oh, yeah, we're still playing their music 40 years from now?
And a six-minute song, or what? How long is
the bathroom songs?
Yeah. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody is up there in time.
Yeah, it is. I don't know. I can't remember. 6.5, 7 minutes. In a pretty cabinet, at the vacation, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. Song after song after song that you hear by Queen and so many of these artists, just and they get you moving, and they just, you know, they just resonate with us in a way that I don't know. It's just one of those things. Duff, what about artists that you liked but you thought there is no way listeners are going to get it? There's no way. Were you ever in that position, like the producer in the Queen movie who said, forget it, nobody's going to listen to this song?
Tony Basil, Mickey.
Oh.
Oh, Mickey, you're so fine.
Who could have predicted that, right?
Yeah, who would have ever thought? Culture Club. I was wrong on that one. They were huge. Cyndi Lauper. It was like, girls just want to have fun. Yeah, this is a novelty record, but look at how big her career was. Who would have thought?
Right.
You know, so many bands back in that in the late 70s and 80s, it was endless. As you know, my desk looked like Christmas every day, and it was like this pile of records. You had the responsibility to add 3 to 5 songs in a given week, but you could have added, no doubt, 10 to 15 every week because there was so many bands and so many songs you'd go in and listen to and say, that's going to be a huge hit, or that's not going to be a hit, and then it ends up being a hit.
It was really disheartening when we used to travel around the Midwest and visit radio stations and drop our record off and say, can you play it? And you'd come into the program director's office and there'd be 150 records sitting there that he hadn't even gotten to yet.
Right.
Yeah.
They're
like, okay, thank you. Have a good day, you know.
Well, was it intimidating?
It must have been a little bit. Yeah, it was.
The intimidation was the record people that would call Fridays and Mondays and almost at one point threaten you if you didn't add their record.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'd probably have 30, and an average of 30 calls a week, just hawking records and stuff. It was quite a job, but you learned a lot.
It's changed, too, hasn't it? I mean, it's a lot different how things are done today.
Yeah, they don't promote like they used to at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think with 1990 when Nirvana came out, and I think that was like the end of classic rock.
Right.
Starting in the 70s, you know, radio kind of changed after that too, didn't it, Duff?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And things have gotten, on some levels, a little homogenized. And again, like we had talked to earlier to the listener, like everything else, it's a business and times change. And with that, you know, business plans and everything else changes. So as much as we'd love to be like the old days, it just doesn't work sometimes.
We're getting close on time here, but I just want to ask you both, who's the best classic rock artist of all time, Mitch?
I would have to go with Deep Purple.
Deep Purple. Okay. Duff, what about you? Who's the best classic rock artist of all time?
Aircraft.
Yeah.
I love it.
The best rock band from Athens.
Yes.
Actually, quite honestly, there was a reason we played Aircraft back then. They were great guys. They were local, very popular. They wrote great music and backed it up with a great lead singer. It was incredible, and it sounded great on the air. I don't have a favorite artist because the list to me is endless, and it wouldn't be fair to me to name just one group because I don't have just one group. I've got many.
Right. Well, you know, for those of us who experienced this music back then as it was being released, there's kind of this satisfaction knowing that these great rock songs decades ago, they continue to resonate in the 21st century. I don't know that we're ever going to see a movement quite like this again, quite as enduring. And I don't think it's just because of the changing formats of music, though that's certainly going to be a force. But I think it's because of the demographics who are into classic rock and kind of their ability to dominate the cultural landscape, if you will. I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Just so great to have you both here. That's all the time we have on Route 51. I want to thank our guests, Duff Damos, NRG Media, and songwriter, studio engineer Mitch Vigut for joining us in the studio. Rick Ryer is our executive producer. Thanks to Joy Ratch-Kramer for producing today's program and for on-air production. John Altenberg composed the Route 51 theme. Special music today from Phil Collins, the Steve Miller Band, Aircraft, Bee Gees, the Rolling Stones, the Eagles, Grand Funk Railroad, Blondie, the Eurythmics, Steely Dan, and the Beatles, and of course, Styx. I'm Shereen Seward in for Glenn Moberg. Next week, Rick Ryer is back in the chair with UW Stevens Point Professor of History Brett Barker, taking us down an interesting journey through Wisconsin history. Until then, we're heading out of town.